Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 10th of August, these are our main stories. President Trump says there's bipartisan support in Congress for tougher background checks on people buying guns. There are reports of more fighting in the southern Yemeni port of Aden between two rival factions of the pro-government alliance. And Portugal is introducing emergency fuel rationing as tanker drivers prepare to go on strike. Also in this podcast,
Blake wanted something a little bit more. So he thought about it for a while and he said, I want a shirt that says, I will be your friend, so that people that don't have friends can know that they have a friend already.
We'll hear more about that special T-shirt that a six-year-old boy wanted for his first day back at school. The United States has more guns than any other country in the world. In fact, there are more guns than there are citizens. But the two recent mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton have again made some Americans question the country's gun laws and demand changes. On Friday, speaking next to the Marine One helicopter, President Trump said serious discussions on background checks for gun owners are taking place.
We need intelligent background checks, okay? This isn't a question of NRA, Republican or Democrat. I spoke to senators that in some cases, people, friends of mine, but pretty hardline senators. Hardline, and when I say that in a positive way. Hardline on the Second Amendment. And they understand we don't want insane people, mentally ill people, bad people, dangerous people. We don't want guns in the hands of the wrong people.
Our correspondent in Washington, Chris Buckler, told us what he made of Donald Trump's comments.
He's trying to reinforce the idea that, as far as he's concerned, the responsibility lies with the individual who pulls the trigger, rather than the relatively easy access to guns in America. And over again, he talked about mental health, saying there needed to be what he kept on describing as meaningful background checks. And there are sometimes gaps whenever guns are sold in America where not necessarily full checks are done on people who are buying these guns. And he said that there was this danger that people who were mentally ill could get hold of the weapons. But at the same time, he also admitted that it was possible that those gunmen who were responsible for the attacks in Dayton, Ohio, and El Paso, Texas, in the last week could maybe have not been flagged up by the background checks to be carried out. And as a result, there will be this pressure for more gun laws, tighter legislation on guns that goes even beyond what the president is suggesting.
And obviously, America has an incredibly powerful gun lobby. How might they be expected to react to the prospect of enhanced background checks?
Well, the National Rifle Association has already made clear that it is against any further background checks, any further legislation around guns. And what was interesting from the president today as he made those comments is he kept on saying that he'd been speaking to the NRA, the National Rifle Association. He'd had discussions with them. He'd a great relationship with them. And indeed, he talked about wanting to make sure that their views were represented and respected within the debate. That gives you a sense that he is going to listen to the NRA. And the danger in all of this is that if you look back a year, whenever we talked about the potential of new gun laws in America after the shootings in Parkland, Florida, at a high school there. Again, we had President Trump in a room with victims and survivors of gun violence, and he was saying, I'm going to change the law. A matter of days later, he talked to the NRA, and he seemed to change his mind, and relatively little has happened in terms of gun laws since then. So it gives you this idea that there's going to be these discussions, but the concern for Democrats is while there may be a lot of talk, there won't necessarily be action.
Chris Buckler in Washington. In Yemen, at least six civilians have been killed in the city of Aden in continued violent clashes between supposed allies in the civil war. The pro-government forces are battling a group who want independence for the south of the country. They've previously fought the Houthi rebels together. Our Middle East regional editor is Alan Johnston.
For the past 3 days since Wednesday, we've heard of waves of clashes in Aden, this crowded port city at the very tip of the south of the country. And as I say, crowded, so civilians are getting caught up in this. We hear, for example, that a mortar slammed into a house, killing 6 people, one report tells us, including 4 members of the same family. The Interior Ministry is warning people to stay at home, but as I've just said, perhaps they're not going to be altogether safe there either. This will be a hugely worrying time for everybody in Aden.
And just to step back for a second, what is it all about? What's at the root of it and who's all involved?
We've talked about war and violence in Yemen on this programme for years. Of course, talking about the civil war, which pits on the one hand the Houthi rebels and on the other the government side. But this is slightly different. This is all about violence from within the ranks of the government alliance. On the one hand, in this fighting in Aden now, you have elements like the Presidential Guard, pro-government troops, and on the other, local separatists. These are separatists who want South Yemen to break away from the north of the country. They want to re-establish the independence that South Yemen enjoyed until the mid-90s.
That was Alan Johnston. India has told Pakistan that it must accept the new reality in Kashmir and stop misleading the world about the Indian-administered territory. Pakistan has embarked on a diplomatic offensive since Delhi revoked Kashmir's special status on Monday. Pakistan has also responded by suspending train links and halting trade. Our correspondent Yogita Lemoye is inside Indian-administered Kashmir and reports from the main city of Srinagar.
A spontaneous protest by men who had just offered Friday prayers. They marched through small alleys around the mosque because they weren't allowed to go out on the main streets. Anger has been growing in Indian-administered Kashmir after the national government removed its special status on Monday.
We have been completely betrayed. They put a gun to our heads and told us that a few people in the government have decided our fate.
In many areas, young men came out pelting stones at security forces. Soldiers fired lead pellets and tear gas to control the mobs. Hundreds of thousands of extra troops have been deployed in the region. Phone and internet lines have been cut off for days now. Leaders who have long been demanding an independent Kashmir have been sent out of the region. Top politicians from the area remain under house arrest. The Indian government is taking no chances, fearing that the situation could spiral into widespread unrest. Outside Kashmir, Prime Minister Modi is being hailed by a majority of Indians. Many say he's made a bold move that will help control terrorism.
That was Yogita Lemoye in Srinagar. Portugal has introduced fuel rationing from midnight local time on Friday ahead of a strike by unions representing the drivers of dangerous goods lorries. Alison Roberts reports from Lisbon.
Portugal's government declared an energy crisis at a cabinet meeting, suggesting that it expects last-ditch talks between lorry drivers and road hauliers to fail and the strike to start on Monday. Fuel rationing was announced from midnight for 12 days, with the public allowed to buy no more than 15 litres of petrol or diesel at filling stations designated as strategic, to which supplies are to be guaranteed. Officials have also felt the need to remind people that storing jerry cans full of fuel is illegal. Unions are to decide whether to go ahead with the strike for higher wages and better working conditions after final talks with employers.
Alison Roberts in Portugal. Large parts of Britain suffered a major power failure on Friday evening, causing widespread disruption to transport. Rail services were particularly affected, with passengers stranded for hours on some trains. Many services out of London were cancelled as commuters tried to head home. This traveller, Alison Davis, was on a train from the city of Leeds in northern England to London's King's Cross station, which was forced to turn back.
We were told that there was a problem with the overhead cables, and then as we were moving into Peterborough it started to slow down, and then we got past Peterborough and it came to a halt, and we were told that the train was then turning round because King's Cross was closed.
The journalist Stig Abel was on a train between Edinburgh and London when the outage happened.
We ended up in a place called Sandy, where the train ground to a halt for 2 hours. They then reversed the train back to Peterborough. I'm now at a Peterborough station filled with people saying, how are we getting to London? To which the answer is, nobody knows.
The power cuts also caused other problems. Traffic lights were knocked out in some cities and hundreds of thousands of homes were left without electricity. The authorities say that the initial problem, the failure of two generators, was resolved within hours. Scientists working on the Great Barrier Reef in Australia have found that corals can be killed almost instantly by marine heat waves, which cause a spike in sea temperatures and are becoming increasingly frequent because of climate change. They studied the northern part of the reef between 2016 and 2017 and published their findings in the journal Current Biology. Here's our science correspondent, Victoria Gill.
As colourful and complex as coral reefs are, these hard structures rooted to the ocean floor can appear indestructible. But most corals are actually made up of thousands of tiny animals, all building that delicate skeleton. This team of researchers in Australia studied what happened to coral during a severe marine heatwave in the northern part of the Great Barrier Reef. They found that the impact of this high temperature event went beyond the more familiar phenomenon of bleaching, where the coral remains intact and can ultimately survive. In a heatwave, as Dr. Tracy Ainsworth from the University of New South Wales explained, corals became so severely weakened that some fragments actually broke off from the reef.
It is irreversible damage. The temperature environment is so extreme that the coral itself is completely overcome. So the animal that made that lace skeleton has died. It's completely irreversible damage, and it is caused by what we're doing to the planet, how intensely our climate is changing and how quickly and how much our oceans are heating up.
Scientists say climate change is fueling an increase in the frequency and severity of these marine heat waves. But they also stress that every action anyone takes to reduce their carbon emissions can influence the trajectory our planet and our oceans are on.
That was Victoria Gill. Still to come in this podcast.
A group of about 25 women line up, each with a baby in her arms. Three among them are below the age of 17.
How some in Kenya are trying to reduce the teenage pregnancies that cause so many girls to drop out of education. China's aviation regulator has ordered the Hong Kong-based airline Cathay Pacific to suspend any staff who support pro-democracy protests in the territory. It says they must be banned from flying into or over the mainland starting on Saturday. In a statement, Cathay Pacific said it didn't condone any activities that would jeopardise Hong Kong's stability, but respected people's right to express themselves peacefully. China's demand coincided with a sit-down protest by thousands of demonstrators who have occupied the arrivals hall at Hong Kong's international airport. Hong Kong's leader, Carrie Lam, accused protesters of not caring if they destroy the territory's economy. Our correspondent, Stephen McDonnell, filed this report from a noisy area in the city's international airport.
As Hong Kong gears up for another weekend of unrest, the city's leader, Carrie Lam, has promised many more arrests if we see yet more of these running street battles between demonstrators and riot police. In terms of the demands of these protesters, one is to have an independent inquiry into the police. Carrie Lam said today there will not be an independent inquiry because the police are carrying out their own investigation. But really what this has become now is a push for democracy. What these people want, their key demand, is to be able to choose who their leader is. They are today no closer to achieving that. Carrie Lam showing no sign that she's moving in that direction, nor is Beijing.
That was Stephen McDonnell in Hong Kong. Teenage pregnancies account for a quarter of all school dropouts in sub-Saharan Africa, according to the United Nations Population Fund. In Kenya, 2 out of every 10 girls between the ages of 15 and 19 are reported to be pregnant or have a child already. The regions with the highest levels of teen pregnancy are Narok County and Kwale County near the coast. In Kwale, parents are now putting their daughters, some as young as 10 years old, on contraception in an attempt to keep them in school. The BBC's Mercy Juma reports.
A few minutes before midday, a Swahili lesson gets underway at a primary school in Kwale County, Kenya. The pupils in this room are aged between 12 years and 16 years. They will be sitting their national primary school exam later in the year. Among them are two girls who are pregnant. A few kilometers from this school, in a local dispensary, a group of about 25 women line up at the reception area, each with a baby in her arms. Three among them are below the age of 17. Clara, not her real name, is the youngest. She has just turned 13. She gave birth 6 weeks ago and has been brought to this clinic by her mother to get a family planning injection. Clara helps the nurse roll up the sleeve of her school uniform. She does not flinch as the needle pierces her arm. Her mother, seated across her, says this is the best thing for her daughter.
I am in pain, but what do I do? She has already made a mistake. Now she has been given a 3 month contraceptive injection, and after that time elapses, she will get another shot. She will use that method until she finishes school. I will remain at home with the baby and give her milk as she goes to school. At 11 a.m., I will take the baby to her school so that she can breastfeed her.
In the same room, Clara's baby also gets her scheduled 6 weeks immunization. Child and teenage pregnancies have become prevalent in parts of Kenya. The coastal area of Kwale is among the most affected, leading to high rates of school dropouts and a continuous cycle of poverty. This has led parents like Clara's mother to put their children on contraceptives, they say, out of desperation. Simon Gumbau, a reproductive health nurse, serves in a small facility in the outskirts of Kwale.
Those who came for contraceptives last year, those who were teenagers, there were 271, those who came for the contraceptives. And below 14, there were 29. Some come without their parents knowing, some are being accompanied by their parents, especially the mother. They are not worried about HIV or STI, they are worried on pregnancy.
I am in Tiribe Primary School in Kwale, and under a huge tamarind tree, young girls and boys are seated. There is a team of people talking to them about safe sex and family planning, and these are young health officials from the local dispensary. They have with them different types of contraceptives. I can see a condom, a pack of family planning pills, a coil, and an implant. They refer to these sessions as peer-led sexual education forums.
Say no to sex.
Say no to sex.
Teachers and health officials say they do advocate for abstinence, but not all adhere to that. Therefore, in such forums, the pupils are taught about the benefits of contraceptives and the various options available. In the meantime, many young people continue to operate in a space riddled with misinformation, myths, and misconceptions, and parents are becoming increasingly desperate. As others head back to class for the afternoon lessons, Clara has to forego them. She begins a 1.5 hour walk from the dispensary to take her child back home.
That report by Mercy Juma. To Burundi now, and a six-year-old boy who's died of malaria. Not, unfortunately, an unusual event regarding the disease on the African continent, but in Burundi, this death made the headlines. In part, it's because the child in question was a celebrity. Darcy Irakoze, a.k.a. Catcherman, was known for his comic stand-up routines, such as this one.
Hello, Papa. Obutundi. Look who I'm here. What are you doing, Papa?
But Darcy Irokosi's death also comes in a week when the United Nations sounded the alarm on malaria deaths in Burundi, saying 1,800 people have died of malaria this year. The World Health Organization now says the situation should be considered an epidemic. What does that mean in practice? Audrey Brown spoke to Dr. Abaka Kalu, the WHO team leader for malaria in Africa.
There is a threshold, and that threshold is based on the number of cases in the previous 5 years. So that threshold has been reached in Burundi this year, and therefore that's why we are concerned that we need to do something special to save lives.
So when you declare it an epidemic, are there measures that you have to take?
Yes, as an organization, when we believe that there is an epidemic, it's a health emergency, then the WHO's framework for health emergency kicks in. And that has happened within WHO. We have an incident manager. An incident management system is being set up, and we have boots on the ground.
The government in Burundi, though, doesn't seem to agree with you.
Well, I don't think they disagree. We all agree there is an excessive number of cases. In fact, every single malaria death is a preventable death. Of course, the national surveillance system is what we rely on to count the cases. As the cases are reported, of course, government has the responsibility to review the cases. So I believe that's what's going on the ground. Government is looking at the numbers and certifying those that are malaria, those that are not. But I don't think the issues of the numbers are a major problem.
Dr. Agbaka Kalu, the WHO team leader for malaria in Africa. Here in Britain, a church warden's been found guilty of murdering an author after tricking him into changing his will. 28-year-old Benjamin Field targeted 69-year-old Peter Farker for financial gain. He gave him drugs to make him question his sanity and laced his drinks with extra strong alcohol. Tom Simons has this report.
Peter Farker was rendered physically helpless by Ben Field's campaign of abuse. Field was secretly lacing Mr. Farker's food with drugs and neat alcohol, resulting in him falling and believing he was developing dementia. Field even videoed his victim's confusion. Field, decades younger, had even pledged to marry Peter Farker. In fact, he was killing him slowly for his money. Police principal investigator Mark Glover said it was all part of his plan.
Here is a cold, calculating, devious man who took pleasure from inflicting both physical and mental torment on his victim, evil.
When Peter Farker died, alcohol was suspected to be the cause. But Ben Field inherited his house and then began another complex deception. His target this time was 83-year-old Anna Moore Martin, who lived four doors away. It was a sexual relationship, and he wrote bizarre religious messages on her mirrors to exploit her beliefs. He persuaded her to withdraw £27,000 from her bank. Anna Moore Martin's niece told the police, who pieced together Field's relationships, exhumed and re-examined Peter Farker's body. Field has already admitted defrauding both his victims. Today he was convicted of suffocating Peter Farker. His friend Martin Smith was cleared of charges that he'd helped. In a statement read by the police, Mr. Farker's family said there were lessons to be learnt.
If people hear this story, we hope that they are very, very careful if somebody unexpected walks into the life of a loved one when that loved one is vulnerable and lonely. There must be other people out there like Ben Field, and we would not want anyone to have to go through the things that we have.
Sadly, Anna Moore Martin died later of natural causes, her final years blighted by Ben Field. Sentencing in his case has been postponed while he undergoes a psychiatric assessment.
That report by Tom Simons. Now, time for a lovely story that we've seen lots of people reading online. It's about a 6-year-old boy called Blake from Atlanta in the United States. Blake had his first day back at school on Monday, and he decided to wear a T-shirt that said, "I will be your friend," so that other children wouldn't feel lonely. Chloe Tilley spoke to Blake's mom, Nikki.
So I run a business just out of home because I'm a stay-at-home mom of four. And I just wanted something to kind of make ends meet. And part of what I do is make T-shirts. And they're just custom. And so I told the kids that they could have whatever they want for back to school. I have two of mine are in school, so it's Blake and his sister Brooke, and she started pre-K. But Brooklyn wanted something with glitter, but Blake wanted something a little bit more. So he thought about it for a while, and he said, I want a shirt that says, I will be your friend, so that people that don't have friends can know that they have a friend already. So
Blake,
I thought that was pretty neat.
It is, and Blake, that's really kind. Why did you want that written on your T-shirt?
You can answer her.
It's right. If Blake doesn't want to have a chat, it's absolutely not a problem. I've got a 7-year-old and a 10-year-old, and quite frequently my 7-year-old doesn't want to talk either. So I completely understand. But that is really kind for Blake at the age of 6 to even contemplate other kids' feelings. That's quite unusual, isn't it, at that age?
It is. It is. He's always had a heart for others. And I've seen, you know, even when he was like really little, like, as a toddler, he had a heart for others. But then within this last year, he's become a Christian, and I've seen it just explode since then. It's really blossomed.
So he wanted this message so that kids, if they were lonely, if they were being bullied or whatever, that they knew that they could go and talk to Blake.
Yes. Uh-huh. And then he specifically chose the colors, too, so that it's brighter and it catches your eye more. So that they would know.
So what reaction was there?
Oh, he said a lot of people recognized him and said, hey, you're the kid from the news. So he got a lot of new friends from that.
And so what happens next then? Is Blake now going to start coming up with a different phrase on a T-shirt for every term or every year? I mean, has he got any other plans for this?
He didn't know this would take off. He still doesn't even understand. He still doesn't even understand the scope of what's happening. He thinks it's pretty cool that he's talking to somebody who's in the same country as the Queen.
Don't worry, Blake. We think Chloe's a bit scary too. Blake's mother, Nikki, was talking from Atlanta in the United States. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this one or the topics we've covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard. Until next time, goodbye.
Music life.
Music life.
Music life.
Music life.
It's about how you love music.
Is anyone listening to what I'm making?
Wow, that's so cool.
Oh, that sounds sick.
It's a really beautiful song.
You can't see me, but I'm really excited.
Speaking to musicians from across the globe.
We're in private jets and 5-star hotels and all the rock star trimmings.
You're both on the same album of mine, but you've never met.
That's so cool.
About how they make their music.
Yo, this is a banger, man.
I know, I need to just give some extra energy.
Finding out all about their creative processes.
When you change things, you surprise people.
Oh, okay. We like this? Okay. We're not annoying anyone. Yeah. Right?
And getting to the bottom of why they do what they do.
When someone comes up to you and tells you how your song helped them through a time, for me, that's the most satisfying thing.
Music Life, a brand new podcast from the BBC World Service. Find the first 3 episodes now by searching for Music Life wherever you found this podcast.